Good evening. Oh, you can all hear me, eh? I can't shout, you know. I'm also the granddaughter of Chief Dan George. I know some snow on the roofs here. You probably might have heard of him. He was the first indigenous man to be nominated for an Oscar. The comments that people made, some of whom I heard, was, I can't believe they're going to give an Indian an award for being an Indian. And I don't know if you know, but he had to learn Cheyenne. And his original language is Hukumilam. So I'll say something in Hukumilam so you know the difference. That's hello in my language, my grandfather's language. And Tansi is hello in Korean. So you see there's quite a difference. He also had a terrific memory, and I want to tell you a little story about that before we get on to the serious business of reconciliation. This fellow, a white guy, he heard that Indians had really good memories on the West Coast, so he went over to the reservation from San Francisco, and he saw this old man sitting on the road. So he said to him, "What did you eat for breakfast 10 years ago?" And the old man answers, "Eggs." He says, "Everybody eats eggs for breakfast." And he goes back to San Francisco. About 5 years later, he returns to that same village. He does his little racist thing and says, "How?" And the old man says, "Scrambled." My grandfather was an actor. And the first show he did was by a fellow in Canada named Paul St. Pierre, and not very many people know that Paul St. Pierre was Tocotin and French. And the white guy they hired to play old Antoine died 3 days before the shoot. And my dad was one of the actors in that film. The first native actor in Canada was my father. And he said, "Why don't you try my dad? He's an Indian." And he speaks Tocotin, which is not our language, but my grandfather always went to the Tocotin for the summer, and he learned their language. He spoke 3 other native languages plus English. He was quite the linguistic character. Apparently that was common for our old people then. So he did. My dad read the script to him because my grandfather had spent 10 years in residential school and didn't learn a stitch of reading. I think that's the big crime of residential schools in his and my father's age group. I taught my sister, who went to residential school, how to read. I went to public school. And I have to say, I didn't appreciate the little white kids who beat me up every day, but I was okay with that because I was learning. I was learning. And my father and my grandfather did not learn very much in those institutions. But my father makes great shoes. I don't know if you know, but that was one of the courses he took at residential school, along with learning prayers. But the other thing he learned at residential school, and I'm eternally grateful for this, if it's for a minute I'll tell you later, but he learned to sing opera. And he could sing like Pavarotti. And he even got hired to play in operas occasionally. Because, you know, he was dark enough to look Italian. Italians would play Indians, Indians play Italians. They just stuck a curly wig on his head and away he went, singing opera. But also he passed that love of opera on to one of my children. And for that he was called Transformer, because he brought our singing together with European singing. He became one of the most accomplished musicians in Vancouver. He was one of Clint Eastwood's teachers for jazz in his movie with his son. Honky Tonk Man, I think it's called. Anyway, My father taught a lot of music to the stars. So I learned early that famous people are just people. They come to your house, they visit, they go. I met all kinds of them. And they came to my grandfather's funeral, of course. And they became friends of ours. But out of that, we got to meet with a fellow named Tommy Douglas, who was named last century's greatest Canadian. Not for what he did for Indigenous people, but what he did for Canada. I think it's called Medicare, right? But what he did for us is he declared us citizens. Now, none of my family appreciated that, because we don't consider ourselves Canadians. We are Stalo. We will always be Stalo. You can declare us anything, but we're still Stalo. But we did like this part. We could go to law school, and we could sue your butts. And we have been winning, and particularly the Chilcotins. One of the things that residential school did not do was educate us. And that, I think, is one of the crimes that's not mentioned in the 94 calls to action. So that door is still open for some lawsuits. Failure to educate. A young Canadian girl was declared retarded and sent to an institution. She was white, from Edmonton. When she got older, she went to university and got a law degree, sued Canada for $1 million for failure to educate. Some of us are having a look at that. Failure to educate. Now, I have to say, this is not the church's fault. Just down the road, there's a university. They're going to have me talk there. That should be fun. Name Ryerson. He's the guy that said we were not fit for academia. At the very same moment that two doctors, one Ojibwe and one Nofroni, graduated from University of Toronto Medical School. At the same time, he declared us unfit for academic learning. And the government went with his plan, which is just to have us do physical labor. So my sister came out of that school very accomplished pie maker and shirt starcher. And my father came out a very accomplished shoemaker. Unfortunately, they don't make shoes anymore quite like they did in residential school. They come from Bata Shoe Company. But anyway, that's another story. All of this became part of who we became afterwards. In 1750, there was a group of Indians on the, I think it was the Humber River, looking at a group of white folks on the other side of the river. And the indigenous people, I think they were Mississaugas at the time, were laughing at the white men who were all drunk. And they were doing terrible things. And the Mississaugas couldn't figure out why would they drink that stuff that made them do all these stupid things. But they were laughing at the white guys. And now those tables are turned. 100 years at residential school, and 90% of us in 1978 were alcoholics in my community. I was a sober 18-year-old, and I was the only one. I have 22 siblings, so that's a pretty lonely place to be the only sober person in your family. And my aunts and uncles were also not sober. Only my grandfather was sober until my grandma died, and then he joined everybody else. And so I spent the first 20 years of my adult life trying to get some people to sober up and be my friend. And I did. And I think that's why St. Thomas gave me that honorary doctorate was for the healing work I did. You would think it for the books I write, but no, it was for healing work because I sobered up an awful lot of indigenous people. And what I found out was this, and there's studies done on it, that when you restore culture, people sober up. The thing that I know about the body is the body has a number of languages, and we've always maintained that. The body speaks. And we've always maintained that the body speaks its original language. So if any of you are Irish, you're not in communication with yourself unless your mind speaks Celtic. When we were told not to speak our language, we lost connection to our bodies. Because our bodies still speak, in my case, Halkamilab. And my mind, if it does not speak Halkamilab, then we cannot communicate with our bodies, with our minds. And for whatever you think about indigenous philosophy, the mind-body-heart, you know, connection that we've always believed in, science now agrees with us. Science has now verified that, in fact, your cells communicate on a number of levels. There's a number of systems in your body. The respiratory system has to talk to the brain. The digestive system has to talk to the brain and say, don't eat that cake. Eat the veggies. In your case, this guy's case, his wife. You know, I heard him talking. But if you don't listen, then of course you don't enjoy good health. But if you don't understand the language the body's talking to you in, you can't understand your body. And we went from people that could, at 12 years old, outrun the American cavalry, to people that can't run to the corner store. We're the unhealthiest people in Canada right now. My children are different, though. I made sure that they learned their language, and I made sure they ate only their foods. Because that was the other part. My great uncle Katsalanok was the fellow that talked to the archivist of Vancouver as the most astute historian in Vancouver. My great uncle Katsalanok could recite to the archivist the names of the first 1,000 settlers and who they married. Couldn't read a stitch, but he could remember stuff. So that's why Major Matthews liked him. But he said they changed everything, the way we eat everything. They even changed the way the Chinese people eat. Now, I have to tell you this, because we grew up next door to the Chinese people. There was Sinok was here. Chinatown was there. Small body of water separating us. And a lot of us are mixed with Chinese. Don't know if you know that, but Arthur Manuel just passed on, and his father was mixed with Chinese from the railroad. But in any case, we were friendly with them, and the Chinese were friendly with us as well at the time. And we communicated with one another. So Katsalanok witnessed that they changed the way the Chinese eat by outlawing Chinese vegetables. At one time in this country, you could not buy bok choy. I think it's ridiculous. But that's one of the things. And at the same time, we weren't allowed to sing. Wo-hee-lo. That's one of the first lines in my grandfather's song. He learned it on a mountain, and he kept it there, away from anybody else, so that he wouldn't go to jail for singing our songs. In my new story about mink, I was chuckling about that, because mink says, I don't know, singing seems a little extreme to me. What harm could it do? But anyway, he's the narrator of my new novel, and it's quite comic. because it's sort of based on my father and a fellow named Coochie, the storytellers in my family, who always thought everything that white folks did was funny. He was on a bus, my dad, and this old man says, don't you hate that? Look at those people. They're not even speaking English. And he says, no, they're not. And he says, they should all go back where they came from. And my dad says, long as you mean all of you.
And then he realizes that he's not talking to a white guy.
And changed that man's mind through comedy. He was a very, very great comic. I found him annoying most of the time. I was a very serious child. And we didn't have any serious conversations, him and I, until I wrote Celia's Song, which was based on the double-headed serpent. And my father is the keeper of that story, and I also am. And it was also connected to residential school and all the healing work I've ever done. And Indigenous women that read it get it. They know what I'm saying in that story because they know my healing work and they know their own healing work. And so it's sort of playing out how all this works in our world and how to undo the damage. We do not need help with the healing. What we don't have is the opportunity to do the kind of projects that would get us there faster. And I think that's one of the things that they talk about, that the church should raise money for projects. And I hope you do. Because there's an awful lot of young people that have applied for very many Canadian grants and not getting them. Most of the grants, they're going out on the reconciliation work or on heritage work, the 150th, okay, whatever, you guys been here a lot longer than that, but anyway, we'll go with that, the 150th anniversary of Canada, a lot of the people that are getting those grants are non-Native people, and I have to say that that's the same old story. That's a continuation of the same old story. Sort of reminds me of this, you know. The Irish came during the potato famine. I don't know if you know this. But 50,000 of them left Ireland. Then they landed on this island. After a year on that island, there was 35,000. Can you imagine 15,000 dying before your very eyes? They got them off the island and into Cabbage Town, called Cabbage Town because that's all they let them eat was cabbage for a year. After a year, 15,000 of them were left. So more than half died in Cabbage Town. Then they decided to give them the Huron Tract. This is the best part of the story. The Huron Tract is over your Kincardine and all those places. Fort Erie and down there. There were no Indians there because they were all dead. Hurons were dead by then. That's another story. Not going to go into it. And there was no road back. There is still no straight road from the Huron Tract to Toronto. After all these years, they have to go zig, 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 zig. I know, because I did a show down there. I'm an actor, too, right? I did a show at the end of the Huron Tract. And it would take us 3 hours to make 70 miles. We'd be going like this in a maze. And I had to find out, why is this? Everywhere else in Ontario, you get a straight road to Sault Ste. Marie. You get a straight road to Montreal. Of course, Indigenous people paid for that. But that's, you know, neither here nor there. We won't talk about that. But not from the Huron Tract. So I asked people about that. And it was so they didn't come back to Toronto if they started to starve. And they did. By the time the snow fell, most of them were starving. And there was some Anishinaabe in Chicago. You know what Chicago means? Stink. Stink. I love that. What's this place called? Chicago. It's stinky. Because of skunk cabbage. But anyway, another story. The Anishinaabe see smoke coming from the Huron Tract, and they say to each other in their language, I don't know any Anishinaabe, or it would be really fun to say it, hey, I thought all those Wendats were dead. How come there's smoke? And they said, I don't know, let's go look. So they go look, and they see all these starving Irish people. And they don't get it, what the explanation is, because, you know, they're speaking Celtic and the Anishinaabes are speaking Anishinaabemowin, you know, the two languages don't coalesce. But they gave them some wild rice and some pemmican and showed them how to feed themselves and built them some lodges. Helped them learn how to build Anishinaabe lodges. And off they went and said they'd come back in the fall time. Check on them. And they ended up at Sault Ste. Marie. Well, the Irish survived. They survived the winter on pemmican and wild rice. And the Anishinaabes came back. And they started to give them seeds for growing food, because the Anishinaabes were gardeners. That's why they call the reserve at Sault Ste. Marie Garden Island, Garden Reserve, and so on. So they gave them some seeds of what they thought was European food, because some of the Europeans don't want to eat foreign food in those days, you know. They'd rather eat a spinach than a dandelion. Even though the spinach has more nutrients. But that's okay. Then, you know, they gave them some seeds. And since then, the people of that area have never forgotten that. And so they invited me down to do a reading. Now, I brought 100 books with me because I know they're Irish. They're going to buy stuff off me. I know it. I always do. I sold out in about 15 minutes. Buffy St. Marie was there with me. She sold out in 20 minutes. I sold out faster. To be fair, she had more CDs than I did. Yeah, thank you. But that's all part of what I call reconciliation that was preceded reconciliation. We do know how to treat each other. Every one of us knows how to treat a human being like a human being. That hasn't happened for us.